My name is Jim Casey. I am the president of the International Association of the Fantastic and the Arts, and I would like to welcome all of you to our panel on Shakespeare and fantastic adaptations. I'm very excited about this panel. Kevin Crawford, who is sitting towards the end, second to the last, and I have done three panels now. Sharon Emmerichs was on one of those panels, and we have two newbies. You might have seen one of them before. So this is our trilogy, or as Kevin refers to it, the triptych of our Shakespeare panels. I'm very pleased to be doing this here. This is my last year as president, and I think there's no better way for me to conclude my presidency than a panel on Shakespeare. I'd like to introduce our panel members. On the end is Sharon Emmerichs. She is at the University of Missouri and a specialist in Shakespeare. Next to her is Kevin Crawford. He's at Reinhardt. He is a Shakespeare professor of theater as well as an academic, and he has published on Shakespeare and presented and created a Shakespeare company. Some guy named Neil Gaiman. And next to me is Connor McCreary. He is the co-creator of the comic Kill Shakespeare. And Connor has also helped to adapt that comic into a play. And that's going to be talked about in one of the sessions. I'll let him tell you about that in a moment. So I wanted to start, first by making sure
that respondent.
Yes, silent respondent, that the bard is represented. I wanted to begin with a brief discussion for those of you who aren't familiar with where the state of the field is in Shakespeare and adaptation. There are several people who are disturbed by the thought of Shakespeare being adapted and not being true, not being real Shakespeare. But among Shakespeare practitioners and theorists, this is not an issue. Shakespeare and adaptation being adapted into sometimes very bizarre ways, extreme ways, is something that we've come to grips with a long time ago. Within the field, this is not an issue of concern. Outside of the field, people get very nervous about this. People freak out if you see a production that's in modern dress instead of Elizabethan dress, which I'll put in quotation marks because it's never really Elizabethan dress. But for most of us, we don't think about this as a concern. As a matter of fact, Shakespearean theorists will think about it more along the lines of a rhizomatic system. If you know what rhizomes are, they're like crabgrass that will spread out, and you'll have roots that drop down, that drop down, that drop down. So instead of like a tree with Shakespeare in the center and everybody else's leaves that come from Shakespeare, they think of it as each one of these as having their own roots and each one being equally valid. I think that's a good way to think about this, and that's actually where I want to start. I want to begin with the concept of Shakespeare not being our trunk of a story. So Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet does not begin with Romeo and Juliet from Shakespeare or Hamlet from Shakespeare. And I'm going to start on the end and ask Sharon if she would comment on that.
Absolutely. Many people feel, as Jim has said, that Shakespeare is the beginning, the nexus, and where everything should start, progress, and end. But the plays that we have from him, we know, came and were adapted from other texts as well. He borrowed heavily from Holinshed, Raphael Holinshed, his histories. He borrowed from Hamlet, from the Spanish tragedy, Thomas Kidd. He collaborated heavily with other authors of his age. And what he produced was, some people call it derivative, some people call it adaptation, some people call it plagiarism, some people call it stealing, but whatever it is that we call it, it is not necessarily something that came into being whole and original and straight from Shakespeare's head. So I find it problematic when other people are saying that we must stay true to Shakespeare, because being true to Shakespeare also means being true to Shakespeare's predecessors, his influences, the people who worked with him, the playgoers that went to his plays, And there's this entire network that we have to consider when we think about Shakespeare's plays. And so I would like to posit the idea that the text is not the thing. Mm. The play is not the thing. That it is the relationships between the play and the culture and the people and the writers and the actors and the playgoers that is the thing. And that people who adapt Shakespeare today into movies, into comic books, into anything you can imagine are staying true to Shakespeare, are staying true to the plays themselves, because they are continuing a tradition that Shakespeare himself was involved in and enjoyed and worked in very, very deliberately and specifically. So when Baz Luhrmann, for example, put Romeo and Juliet in Miami, right, and kept Shakespeare's language in their mouths but put guns in their hands, he's being true to Shakespeare. When the Royal Shakespeare Company puts on The Merchant of Venice and puts them in corporate business offices, they're being true to Shakespeare because they're making the exact same movement that Shakespeare made with the exact same intents that Shakespeare made, I would argue. And that there's this parallelism in for what adaptation actually is. It's a palimpsest, right? It's been written on, scraped off, written over, scraped off, written over again and again and again. And every layer influences every other layer. And as we read it from where we are now, we see all of those layers. And we can't isolate any one of them, I would say. But we must look at them together as a tapestry, as a picture, and see what emerges then and where we can take it next.
Great. Actually, this is going to be very informal in the way that we ask the question, so I'd invite any of the other panelists to respond as well, and we can address it as you feel so moved.
Well, I think actually one of the interesting things that kind of came up there is the notion of, is Shakespeare almost becoming sort of mythology? You know, when you're talking about the building and the scraping, and, you know, many of the people in this room, I think some of our most loved tales are things that are directly, we can say, oh yeah, this came from, you know, this classic Norse tale or whatever it might be, right? There's so many great examples in the fantastic of mythology being repurposed. And I would argue we may be just sort of sliding into the time where Shakespeare is far enough in our rearview mirror that he has become a mythology that is now free for us to build on in any way we want. I mean, I may be biased because that's what Kill Shakespeare does, so of course I think that's a brilliant idea. You know, but I'd like to think that if Shakespeare came around, he would say, you know what, I think he would approve of what we're doing. I don't think he would find it, you know, awful. I don't think he would be really upset that in our world Hamlet meets Juliet or that Lady Macbeth is in bed literally and figuratively with Richard III. I think he would think it was neat. Then he threatened to sue us for copyright infringement. But thankfully he said to kill all the lawyers, so we're one step ahead of you, Bill. But yeah, I think now we've just got a stage where Shakespeare is almost mythology, and that's only going to become more real, I think, as we grapple with especially how we teach Shakespeare. I think it's going to become less and less of something that is flesh and blood in some ways, and more of something that, like many other stories, will be looked back as, oh, those are the tales that other tales were built on. And that this specific argument is probably at an inflection point. And I think most people, at least we've met, we've only had really one person come to us who said we should be bitch slapped. She said that our story made her throw up in her mouth. She said that three times, and that it was bullshit, comma bullshit, comma bullshit. And that was our first review. But that's really the only negative one where we've come down and somebody has said, like, how dare you do this? So, yeah, I think most people are moving past it.
There still are purists who say you should do it the way Shakespeare did it. Well, part of the problem with that is we don't necessarily know how Shakespeare did it all the time. And so a lot of it is guesswork, a lot of it is educated guesswork, but and who's to say that he did it the same way every time? I mean, we don't have the original manuscripts. We don't know what revisions were made. So I think that attitude is a little bit narrow-minded.
Well, actually, if anything, we do know that he adapted his own work. I mean, the only surviving prompt book from The Kingsmen is actually a Middleton play that the Oxford editors have chosen to call The Lady's Tragedy. And it has the equivalent of post-it notes tacked into it. Speeches are cut It's rearranged. There are literally, like, arrows, move this over here. And if it is some kind of synecdoche for what the company did, it's certainly a very powerful one. And the two texts of King Lear, you know, a notorious problem in the past 20 years. I mean, Oxford Shakespeare made the then radical decision to publish two different King Lears in the collected works. I mean, just enough differences between the two texts, not to constitute what we might consider a different play. I mean, Lear is still dead. Fine. Cordelia is still dead. But the war with France is significantly altered enough that, like, somebody changed their mind, whether it was Shakespeare or an actor. I mean, the power of the company members, you know, not having the office of a director as we know it from the late 19th century, there had to have been countless instances of someone, probably Burbage, looking at somebody saying, "You're not really going to make me say that, are you?" or Polonius is the best line in Hamlet for me is, "This is too long." Yeah, there is no such thing as a full-text Hamlet. And I love it when 18-year-old or 20-year-old students, not that they can't have their own thoughts, they puff their chests out when I show a scene or two from Julie Taymor's Titus or Lerman's Romeo and Juliet, and they say, "Well, I'm a purist or I'm a traditionalist." There is no tradition. There was no time for a tradition to build itself or be built. We have original performance conditions, whatever they were, and that's a huge question mark. Theaters are closed. Then we have the Restoration. Then we have Lear's, in which Lear lives. And Cordelia marries Edgar, and Tempest are turned into operas and ballets, and plays disappear from the stage for over 200 years, like Twelfth Night. I mean, some of the more, or the most popular plays of the repertoire just don't appear on stages for centuries. So there is no such thing as tradition. It's not till the early 20th century that we get this kind of fetishizing of original practice and first folio acting techniques and, oh, the punctuation contains acting clues, which is absolute nonsense and demonstrably false. I mean, we have extant texts of retypesetting of the folio when it was decided that Troilus had to follow Romeo instead of Timon. And on one page alone, there's over 100 punctuation changes. And I mean weird ones. I don't mean commas turned into semicolons. I mean periods turned into question marks and question marks turned into exclamation marks or just dropped altogether. Because some compositors said, "Oh shit, I ran out of periods." So that's a tradition that we're supposed to follow and build a master's degree program on? And some schools do that. I mean, University of Delaware has a magnificent classical acting program, but they are folio happy about this stuff. And there are folio zombies walking around saying, "Oh, but that was a dash." Well, for you it might be, but not at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival. Yeah, so I agree entirely.
I discovered Shakespeare really when I was given a bunch of the signet Shakespeares with the Milton Glaser covers for my bar mitzvah. So when I was 13 and read everything, I was just given what I thought were a bunch of books with cool covers. So my first experience with Shakespeare was reading them, and reading the essays and reading the Holinshed and reading all of the extra material. And I thought mostly they were very unsatisfactory as novels went. And it really wasn't until I started seeing them acted that I started making sense of them. And also started making sense in some cases of why things were happening. There is that weird point in Shakespeare when you're sort of reading it and you're going, "Well, why is this scene here?" And then you see it acted and you go, "Well, of course that scene is there, because if that scene wasn't there, he wouldn't be able to run around the back and get changed." And understanding the glorious practicalities of Shakespeare fascinate me. I mean, the fact that, you know, I've adapted Shakespeare now twice, really, in Sandman. I brought him on three times, but did really two Sandman stories that were both driven by Shakespeare and both driven by the two Shakespeare stories, the plays that don't really have other sources, Midsummer Night's Dream and The Tempest, which are you know, fundamentally, significantly more original than any of the other stories in their own ways, although we can point to various things that influence them. And in one, I just loved the idea of trying to tell the story of somebody who was putting on the first ever production of Midsummer Night's Dream in front of an invited audience of Titania and Oberon and all of the fairies, because I thought that would be really fun. And it was the single most painful thing I've ever written. And is Charles Bess, are you around here? Is Charles? No, okay. Charles drew it, and I still feel guilty. because it involved having... The action had to happen backstage, on stage, with the important people right at the front of the audience, and then I got this peanut gallery at the back of the audience, whose function mainly was to explain the plot to any members of the readership who were not actually following what was going on, and also to make good jokes, because, you know, that point where one of them says of Puck, you know, I am that merry wanderer of the night, I am that psychotic fucking menace to life and limb, more like it. I don't think I used the word fucking back then. We weren't vertigo. But, so that was one way of doing it. The second time I did it was completely turned upside down, because it was The Tempest. And I just wanted to do the very last issue of Sandman. And as I headed towards it, I thought, well, let's do something that's all about last stories and ending things. And The Tempest is a story about ending stories. And rather than tell the story of The Tempest, I tried as best I could to tell the story of Shakespeare writing The Tempest and knowing that something was going to be over and something was going to be finished. And that was an absolute delight, bringing Shakespeare on as a character, sort of not really sure if he'd done the right thing by doing this wonderful deal that gave him plays that he would write that would live on long after he was dead. That was what he wanted when he was 20, but now he wasn't sure anymore. And taking him back home to Stratford and just seeing what happened. And I loved it. I mean, I loved the character. I definitely wound up at the end of all of the Shakespeare reading that I had to do, just getting seriously irritated at the peculiar snobbery of Shakespeare cannot have been Shakespeare. When those people start up, you go, oh, right, he had to be a lord, didn't he? Yes, because of all of the great works of literature that have been brought to us by the House of Lords over the years. You know, you want to go, dude, it's Lord Dunsany. That's pretty much it. You can sneak Byron in if you have to, but for fuck's sake. Anyway, there you go.
I have to say, as most Shakespeareans know, the conspiracy theorists are the bane of our existence. Oh. I gave a keynote a few weeks ago, and three very nice elderly one gentleman, two women came up and tried to convert me to believe that Shakespeare did not write the plays. Now, they all have a different candidate. And some of them are quite crazy. You know, Marlowe and Queen Elizabeth have both faked their deaths.
Well, and they wrote it on the grassy knoll.
Right. This tendency, though, to kind of change the stories for Shakespeare and rewrite them and recraft them is very old. As a matter of fact, in Shakespeare's, possibly even in his own lifetime, Thomas Middleton has already adapted Macbeth. That's the edition we have. And we know Middleton added a scene, for example, where we have happy dancing witches. And there's a song that's sung that is great that you never actually see in the Macbeth editions unless you have the Middleton edition of The Witch, which is it's a really crazy, creepy song where a cat comes down, the familiar cat, and they sing to each other, and then they go off on their way. And this begins, Kevin mentioned King Lear. For almost 200 years, everybody believed King Lear ended happily. So this is not something new.
No.
And so I wonder, is there a difference between those kinds of adaptations, these what we might call regular adaptations, where we change the story slightly? Things like A Thousand Acres, both the novel and the film. Mm. Or if you're familiar with Ron, where it's the kind of the underlying story of King Lear set in a different culture. Or Men of Respect, where they're all gangsters. Or things like that. A difference between that and particularly fantastic adaptations. When we change the story, you might be familiar with the anime Romeo times Juliet, maybe? Mm-hmm. Where they've got flying horses with wings and... there are characters from all of Shakespeare's plays that are totally unrelated to the characters in Shakespeare's plays. So, like, serving men, curio's pretty important, by the way. Stories like that that are obviously fantastical, or Stan Lee, by the way, if you don't know who Stan Lee is, with the comics, Fantastic Four, the great superheroes from Marvel, has a Romeo and Juliet story that's kind of set in the future. Or stories, something like Prospero's books, if you're not familiar with Prospero's books.
I was just going to bring that up because Neil was talking about The Tempest.
Yes, like it's a wonderful adaptation of The Tempest with a lot of naked people. But is there a difference between the fantastic adaptations and these what we might call regular adaptations? Or is there a certain way maybe that adaptations are already fantastical?
I think one of the things that allows... the adaptations over and over is that we have texts, whether the texts are correct or not, whether, you know, it's almost beside the point. The existence of the texts allows us to do anything. It allows us to do Forbidden Planet or whatever. It allows us to do Prospero's books. It allows us to put on stage pretty much any kind of Shakespeare you want to imagine, set in whatever period you like, to comment on whatever you want. You can absolutely decide that Macbeth is a commentary on fascism and everybody needs to wear fascist uniforms and you're going to and get away with it. Or you can decide that Macbeth is actually all about the intolerance against pagan religions and push it into that direction. All of these things are absolutely permissible because none of them is considered the production. They're all, you know, the thing is the text, which you can always return to, and is always unchanged by whatever you happen to have done on stage that day.
So you don't lose anything, no matter how you present it to your audience.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I 100% agree.
I mean, theater is first and foremost ephemeral. You cannot reproduce the same production twice. You had one extra cup of coffee that morning, so your Hamlet is really off the rails.
Really? No, it happens.
So in my own particular festival, which takes place outdoors on the ocean in South Florida, one night it's 98 degrees with 400% humidity. You can't see 5 feet in front of your face. And you're pounding Gatorade. The next night, it's balmy. The breeze is coming off the ocean. You're swinging from the rafters. Audiences deserve what they deserve, of course, although we do it for free. But it's going to change. And until we get really into the 20th century and you're dealing with copyright laws and maniacs, brilliant maniacs like Beckett, who have very, very specific stage directions and will sue theater companies if they want to set Endgame rather famously in a post-apocalyptic subway station, that really is a new phenomenon of you have to do it this way, you have to do it that way. I think it was Richard Chamberlain in a revival of My Fair Lady in the late 90s in which the surviving members of the estate who owned the libretto thought the production was just a bit too dark in tone, They weren't objecting to the lighting design. A bit too dark in tone.
Was it their own stage?
Yeah. People weren't tapping their feet enough. And they had to go through another 2 weeks of previews before they allowed it to open. But that's new, as we've all been suggesting.
It's relatively new. I remember reading in Gilbert and Sullivan books published in the 70s, the shock and outrage once the copyright on Gilbert and Sullivan was up in the 1960s, that suddenly you were getting modern dress.
Mm.
Gilbert and Sullivan and you know, people were changing things and you were having black Mikados and this was a terrible thing.
Mm.
And, you know, the idea that suddenly you could change this. So it was definitely, it's definitely been going on for a while, the idea that there were people who wanted to keep things the way
they thought they were.
The way they thought they were.
Yeah. That's like some kind of battle in a lot of ways, right? I mean, I think, you know, I guess the clash of Shakespeare is like any other clash where you've got, there's a certain portion of society that doesn't want things to change, and there's a certain portion of society that's very comfortable with things changing. And there are pros and cons to both of those. I'm sure everybody in this room has seen some sort of adaptation of Shakespeare or read a book or whatever that is meant to have been sprung from Shakespeare that you thought was absolutely horrible and wretched and you hated it and, you know, it annoyed you. And some, not all adaptation is good. But I think it's good that we try to do different things because, I mean, that gives us, you know, one of my favorite issues in comics, you know, which is your Tempest issue, which is one of the things that brought me back into comics when I was in my early 20s. And I sort of thought that comics was a medium that I needed to have kept behind me. And it wasn't a medium that could tell a story that was going to move me and that I had to read something more serious. And then, you know, Sandman and Transmetropolitan got thrown in my hands. And I was really happy that I could go back and play in this medium again and sometimes even visit Spider-Man. And I think the fantastical notion, I mean, you talk about Shakespeare and the fantastical. I mean, Shakespeare is fantastical. The theater is magical. I would argue that comics and theater are actually very close cousins as mediums. Both rely on the written word and, in a weird way, the spoken word. Because when you read a comic, there's something about it being in a bubble that makes it like dialogue in a way that it isn't off the page. And even the most kitchen sink comic book or the most kitchen sink, you know, realism, you know, dramatic play, there's something about seeing it live that makes it magical in a way that film is not in that same way. And comic books, because of the use of angles and the way that layouts can be put together, it's impossible for a comic to be realistic. And so I think that fantastical element is inherent in what Shakespeare's about. And so I think all adaptation of Shakespeare is fantastical, and I don't think you can get too fantastical. You can have better, you know, better and worse attempts at doing it, but I don't think you can ever shy away from trying to adapt Shakespeare and saying, oh, well, that's too much. Because I don't think you can be too much, because Shakespeare's ideas are that big. They're meant to be too much. And then, yeah, like Neil said, you have these amazing moments where you sit there and go, well, all right, so come on, Hamlet. So the pirates take it, like, they had no use for, like, a region from, like, a major European. This was just, I hate my uncle too, I'll drop you off. Like, that's the fun yacht to fill in about Shakespeare.
Yeah. Is there a point where these changes, these adaptations, turn into something different? Homages, pastiches, or even something possibly, you asked, if it might be damaging to Shakespeare? Is that a possibility for it to change into something that's no longer something we would consider an adaptation, but something entirely different?
I'd like to take two steps back to something you had mentioned right in your first answer, a palimpsest. One of the best credit sequences I've seen is for Jean-Jacques Annaud's film of Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose. Mm-hmm. And it actually says, before they list the cast, a palimpsest of Umberto Eco's novel. It's got to be the only film I've ever seen that uses the word palimpsest in its opening titles. And maybe that's too far a step back, but I think what we've been talking about renders almost the very title of our session one redundancy after another. All Shakespeare is adaptation. All adaptation is fantastic. And going back to the beginning and just reversing the terms, all Shakespeare's fantastic, all Shakespeare's adaptation, et cetera, et cetera. In terms of going too far, I just don't know. I mean, I produced an all-female production of Midsummer Night's Dream years ago, which had nothing to do with any kind of artistic vision or I'm going to be bold and daring and whatever. No, guys auditioned. So I had all these women, and I thought, well, I'll just do this. And it worked. You know, it wasn't like a Deborah Warner production with Fiona Shaw as Richard II. It was just, I have no guys. So I will do this with all women. And I didn't, you know, dress it up, doll it up, or anything like that. Women wore pants or women wore skirts. That's how they identified themselves by gender. I know that was simple. That's how much I didn't care about it. And the letters and the phone calls that we got, either in complaint of whatever my disturbed vision was that they thought I had, or in praise of it. I mean, it's very wide-ranging. Young audiences didn't care. The middle school kids we bust in said that after 2 minutes they didn't notice anything. Mm-hmm. Adults said, that director is either sick, a lesbian, or both. Which, in a strange way, I kind of wish I was.
That is the fascinating thing for me about theatre when it works, which is it engages the let's pretend part of your head to the point where absolutely the moment that you go, oh, I get it, the people in the trousers are men, the people in the skirts are women, you can go with it. That is the let's pretend that you have been given.
That's the fantastic.
And it's right up there with the let's pretend that this painting on the back is a palace or is a tree or...
But the same people who complained also said, oh, look, that's a fairy. And believe that. Or somebody said, that's Puck. He can do magic.
Well, it's interesting.
And they don't question that.
Because Jim asked the question, is can it ever be damaging? And a critic came up with a term for adaptation that he specifically aimed at Shakespeare... And it's palimpsestuous, which is that it can become so inbred that either you're just doing the same thing over again, or it becomes unrecognizable, and all of a sudden you have, you know, toothless, you know, little deformed productions. And so that's one of the dangers that people have been writing about, is where is that line between, yes, I recognize this as Shakespeare, or no, this is something altogether new, and I can't even see a relationship to it at this point.
Well, I mean, you can definitely have the bad ones. Has anyone here ever been to the Donkey Show? No, good. The Donkey Show has been running in Boston for... I think 4 or 5 years now, and it's theoretically A Midsummer Night's Dream, and you are at the Oberon nightclub run by Oberon, and it's all kind of Studio 54, and people, it's this show that runs and runs forever because they play 70s disco hits, and people older than me go and they disco the night away. While around them, this weird kind of thing that's a bit like Midsummer Night's Dream is sort of going on at the edges. And I went to see it trying to get Midsummer Night's Dream out of it and hated it, while the people that I was there with who went as a wonderful evening to disco with peculiar bits of entertainment had the most fantastic time. Which is really, I suppose, my way of saying that the definition of palimpsestuous moves depending on where you're standing.
Which reminds me a lot of what you said earlier today about the definition of genre, what you expect to get out of it and miss when it's not there.
Exactly.
Seems to overlap this perfectly.
Mm. Well, it all feels like it's kind of the same moving line of somewhere someone is going to say, well, this is no longer Shakespeare. And at the end of the day, I mean, this is a fuzzy answer. At the end of the day, it's always going to be a personal choice is where I feel that this is no longer Shakespeare.
I've heard this about The Lion King recently. The Lion King is not Hamlet.
How dare you? How dare you?
Exactly.
You know, it's, I mean, I guess you get
that.
One of
my students said that. One of my students adamantly was infuriated by the idea that The Lion King was an adaptation of Hamlet. And, you know, we sort of walked through it a little bit, and no... No,
which I guess
it's not okay.
Which I guess is cool, right? Because everybody's going to have their space of what's sacred and stuff. But in some ways, you're like, oh, chill out. Like, again, you don't have to let. You know, I mean, it's, I guess it comes in the value judgment. I guess maybe we do this with Shakespeare. Shakespeare's one of these, one of our touchstones, and we get that. And it's one of these things that we feel like we need to have an opinion on. And it's interesting when we, you know, we do the Comic-Con circuit. And we either get people who are like big Shakespeare fans who will look over and kill Shakespeare, and we have to have our whole, no, we're here to praise the bard, not to bury him, or else, you know, have somebody like just start, occasionally get very angry. Often, for whatever reason, the Blue Rinse crowd gets really mad at it sometimes, but, or you get people who kind of come in and they pick up the book, but you see that they're kind of, they're shy, they feel like that maybe they don't know enough Shakespeare. And they feel bad about themselves. I can't count the number of conversations I've had with people who apologize to me for not knowing enough Shakespeare. I'm like, okay, first of all, I took Shakespeare through high school. I had a minor in theater in university. I am certainly not, probably one of the least knowledgeable people in absolute terms about Shakespeare in this room. Well, maybe not this room necessarily. I'm thinking back at SAA, but maybe as well here. Certainly on this panel. If that's okay. That's the beauty of Shakespeare, is that you can interact with the bard on whatever level you want to. And I sometimes think the whole argument of what is Shakespeare sort of misses the point. Shakespeare's whatever it is to you, which again is fuzzy, but I think is really valid. And Shakespeare earned that because the quality of the questions he asks in his stories are so universal and so big that we all do interact with Shakespeare on some level. And there's never been somebody who's come to our table, even the people who swear they know nothing about Shakespeare, who don't turn out to know something about Shakespeare, who have a favorite moment or a character or some way they've interacted with Shakespeare that has touched them. And I think that's what Shakespeare's about to me. That's what all great art is about, is that it touches people in a universal way.
I suppose the only time that I get upset when people say that's not Shakespeare is when they're watching Shakespeare and they say, that's not Shakespeare. Why did they put those sex bits in?
Yeah.
Or why did they put that political stuff in? That's not in the original. And I'm
Shakespeare's
what
not
they read?
Funny.
Yeah, Shakespeare's not supposed to be funny. This is serious stuff. And I think, you know, there's a long tradition of turning Shakespeare into Disney. And this goes back to Charles and Mary Lamb and their stories, their children's stories for Shakespeare. And I think that's the only part that I get disturbed. But I know Kevin gets upset when people come up after a modern dress production and say that wasn't Shakespeare. Mm. Shakespeare has to have tights. But I'm not as concerned about that, because if they're listening to the words, if they're seeing what's happening with the characters, then that, for me, is fine as Shakespeare. I get concerned when they say, when they have definitions that say that's not Shakespeare, even though it's in the play. There's a long tradition of saying that bit's not him. That must have been Fletcher, who
right.
co-wrote it with him. That must not be him. That was someone else who wrote it. That was a compositor's error. So they can take things out they don't like and decide this must not be Shakespeare, which is, or that it was actually written by someone else, all those kinds of arguments. I want to come back to specific types of adaptations and ask, and we're going to go down the panel, and I want to talk about what are some of the concerns for adapting Shakespeare that might be different for either other authors or other types of things. And I actually want to frame this within specific media. So I want to start with film, and then within the theater and theater productions, and then literary and comics as well, and then comics specifically. And we'll start on the end with Sharon.
Well, you already mentioned one of the biggest problems with adaptation into film, which is if you stay too close to the original text, Shakespeare's text, you have no imagination. You have no creative movement, right? What did you bring to the party that wasn't there before? And yet if you deviate too much, you're accused of not being true to Shakespeare, not being true to the fundamental elements of Shakespeare. And so it's kind of, I often wonder why anybody even bothers, because it is a lose-lose situation no matter what you're going to do. You're going to piss somebody off. But I think that there are enough people out there who are willing to be imaginative about Shakespeare, that they're interested and curious about the different voices that directors and screenwriters and actors can bring to characters, can bring to situations. And so that's why we have Julie Taymor's Titus, which in some ways is so extreme in terms of representing the play, the characters, and things like that, that a lot of people got really upset by it. And in fact, she was forced to remove several scenes from the movie before it was allowed to be released in the theaters, because people were upset that that's just way too over the top. It's too much. It's going to detract from the experience of the performance. And then you have people like Kenneth Branagh, whose Hamlet, his attempt was to, do the entire play the way he thought that it might originally be produced. So you have this kind of sliding scale of adaptation, and no matter what choices you make, there are pros and cons. There are problems and wonderful, amazing things that occur. You had mentioned that everybody has their one thing that they hate, that were the one adaptation that they... Mine is Ethan Hawke's Hamlet. It makes me so angry. But that's because the choices that were made in that particular adaptation, I thought, were ridiculous. I thought product placement, capitalism, that there were ridiculous reasons for some of the choices that were made. When the choices make sense, when the choices have sound reasons behind them, when they have logic behind them, rational ideas behind them, when there's a unifying thread that brings everything together, even if you don't know what that is until the end, then I think we can recognize a production, a film adaptation, as this is an adaptation of Shakespeare. But when we can't find that, or when the choices seem irrational, when the choices seem random or have unsound reasons behind them, I think that's when we have to, when we step back and say, okay, this is upsetting me. So the filmmakers have this like tight wire that they're walking between two snake pits, and it amazes me how many of them get to the other side.
You're next, Kevin.
Oh, it's my turn.
Thank you for
I thought something really good was about to come out there. You were in the zone. It was like,
no, I was thinking a lot about what Sharon said. I happen to like the film that Michael Almaldar produced with Ethan Hawke in it. I didn't like him so much as Hamlet.
His BBC discussion of Macbeth, though, was quite good, surprisingly so.
The what now?
The BBC, which you can watch online free. BBC discussion of Macbeth. They've started doing a series of all the plays.
Uncovering Shakespeare. Yeah.
Wonderful.
And Sharon brought up another interesting point in terms of film, and I do think it crosses over, obviously, into stage production. Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet was unashamedly billed as the full Hamlet. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's a folio Hamlet conflated with a quarto Hamlet with lines that Branagh wrote and inserted in himself.
Didn't he insert an entire scene?
Well, there are flashback scenes, for film, I think most people can forgive. But no,
I think it's appropriate that came right around the time he did Frankenstein.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it was a true monster, but everything down to the film stock he actually shot it on. This is the first film shot in 80 millimeter and da-da-da-da-da, and it's the first fully realized production of Hamlet. And it's simply not. I don't think it was a malicious misleading of the general Shakespearean public, if there is such a thing. But it is really problematic coming up with a season for a stage audience or, in his case, New Line Cinemas. And Hamlet really represented kind of a peak, because after that, I don't want to say he slid downhill for Love's Labors, which he kind of did. And then As You Like It went straight to Showtime, and he was supposed to have done a Macbeth. He was under contract to do a Macbeth, and they just axed that. So it was kind of the first stirrings of a death knell. But when we pick plays for a summer season, we do have to take into consideration what audiences think Shakespeare's going to be. what they might want to see, anything with a king's name and anything with a king's number after it, we just have to avoid. And it drives me crazy. I would love to do the history plays. We've only done Richard III, and that was 20 years ago. And I wrote the program notes for it, and it confused everybody because the first sentence I stupidly wrote as Edward IV is king, which is true at the beginning of the play, and everybody sat there and thought, oh, shit, I thought I was supposed to see Richard III. And so I'm already on the back foot. And if I ever write some kind of autobiographical story, which nobody would read, it's going to be called Shakespeare in Suits, because we did a Julius Caesar, and it was very, I thought, old hat, an easy way out, Orson Welles-y, fascist, men in Armani suits, modern dress, kind of quasi-Mussolini. And some people walked out within 10 minutes, and one couple was overheard saying, we came to see Shakespeare, not men in suits. So they had formulated some kind of bizarre mathematical equation that Shakespeare does not equal, put the line through it, you know, men in suits. And yet other adaptations that we've put on stage with just cutting, you know, not altering words. I usually do the textual adaptations, which I don't play with vocabulary too much, if at all. Rarely, actually. We did Midsummer Night's Dream, very disco era-ish, Falstaff wore a white John Travolta Saturday Night Fever suit. And audiences nice. Probably went as crazy as Artie.
Falstaff?
Yeah, he did.
In Midsummer Night's Dream?
Oh, did I say Midsummer? I'm yes. sorry. I meant Mary Wise of Windsor.
Okay.
We're talking about that piece.
I thought that was really brave. I thought, whoa, Falstaff in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Now you've given me an idea.
That's so good.
I'm sorry. We did a Mary Wives set in the disco era, and Falstaff wore a Travolta white suit. And I think audiences were, as in, if this is the word, they were as enchanted by the soundtrack during the scene changes as they were the Shakespeare. So that was okay. But you go for the Caesar in suits or Hamlet in black leather and post-apocalyptic, and people get a little edgy about things like that. I don't think in our 24-year history we've ever backed away from something and said, this is way too much. Or we're going to lose audiences, because we do have the benefit of county, state, and private financial support. We do not charge admission. It's outdoor, Shakespeare in a park. We have an amphitheater that seats about 3,000 people a night on the weekend. And they're there as much for the picnic as they are the play. And that's something we're, you know, very, very, well, we're proud of it. But we also can wipe our brow and say, thank God they're not going to blink at Pericles, which very few of them have ever heard of, because they're really just reaching for the bottle of Chardonnay. Yeah. Really. And that's not to say they don't appreciate the play. They often will come up after the show and they bring the children out and they get their program signed. And I didn't know he wrote this. But that's another play of Shakespeare's that, you know, was not in the first folio, that is probably co-authored with Wilkins, at least the first half of the play. They just don't care. But if you get into the major cities and the major festivals, Alabama, Oregon, Utah, certainly New York.
Stanton, people, Virginia.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, I'm going to see Two Noble Kinsmen, which you probably don't know that Shakespeare wrote, in 2 weeks. So some very small places are very successful.
Blackfriars
Theater. You should all go. Stanton, yeah. Virginia, tiny little town.
And that's with Fletcher, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, it's never really a battle. Producers do say, well, what are you going to do with this? What are you going to do with that? But at the end of the day, it's, are we really going to offend somebody? And we don't take out the sex jokes, although Ralph Cohen, who works, I don't know if he's still artistic director with, okay, yeah, his concluding line on a Middleton panel was, forgive the blueness, but do the dick jokes. They're going to get it. They're going to like it. Just don't cut those. Cut the other stuff. But keep that stuff in there because they're going to laugh. And strangely, in terms of a programmatic theory, he's got something there. They're going to laugh. It's the old, well, it's Donald O'Connor. Slip on the banana peel, run up the wall, and do whatever you want to do. But keep it there. I don't think that's selling out in any way. It can be overdone. And I certainly don't like, at least for our festival, the overplaying of pointless slapstick that comes so readily with the early comedies like Comedy of Errors and Two Gentlemen of Verona. But for the most part, they're going to like it. They're going to be okay. I think if they were paying $30 a head, then they would bring a different kind of baggage to the show. They would expect maybe not more, but a different kind of program note, a different kind of, not production value, because I think our values are pretty high, and with equity artists and things like that. But we just don't deal with the questions that other companies do, and that is a relief.
Well, first of all, if you notice me surreptitiously Googling on my phone, I was checking the second author and making sure I had it right. I thought I'd recommend something that is not entirely a literary Shakespearean adaptation, but is my favorite appearance of Shakespeare in literature, which is a book called No Bed for Bacon by Carol Brahms and S.J. Simon. And you may notice, if you read No Bed for Bacon, some of the best jokes and bits seem peculiarly familiar if you've seen Shakespeare in Love, almost as if they had been borrowed by the people who wrote Shakespeare in Love and repurposed. An accusation I could not possibly make. But anyway, No Bed for Bacon, really, really funny, and glorious book about Shakespeare as a very, very practical playwright trying to write Love's Labour's Won and failing while everything else is going on. So the big problems of trying to transfer Shakespeare into literary form or into comics, as I see it, are first of all, Shakespeare doesn't work in comics when you try and do him straight. And I can say that because I have piles at home of attempts at doing Shakespeare graphic novels. It seems like, you know, every 2 or 3 years, some publisher goes, you know what's going to really make money? I'll do Shakespeare as a graphic novel, full text of the play, and we'll get it illustrated, and it's going to be great. And it never, ever, ever is, because... And they've done it with some fantastic artists, have tried. And the trouble is, people talk too long. So either you wind up with enormous great wodges of words, or you wind up with page after page of somebody standing there talking to you. And all of the things that would make Shakespeare fun, and do make Shakespeare fun when it's happening on a stage and somebody's saying it, you basically, if you're writing comics, have about 180 words a page you can put in comfortably. Maybe 200 words a page. But you're kind of pushing it. And it never... So far, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I am saying I have stacks of these things done by fantastic people, and they've all sucked. On the other hand, I think there have been a few absolutely fascinating adaptations of Shakespeare, or things that took Shakespeare into peculiar literary realms. One of my favorites I thought I'd mention is, I don't know if anybody remembers Paul Anderson's Midsummer Night's Tempest. And I think the thing that I loved best about that was he managed to write an entire novel in iambic pentameter, which is barking mad and completely brilliant. And the moment that you're reading it going, there's something a bit odd about this novel, but I don't know what it is. And somewhere around 20, you go, hang on. Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. this entire book is in iambic pentameter. Whoa. I'll give it to you. We're running out of time.
I mean, I guess not to be the dick on the panel, but it's really nice to work in comics because I think the expectations are a little bit different in some ways. I think Neil's absolutely correct. I think it's really hard to do Shakespeare properly in comics. We do a lot of writing sessions for kids when we go around schools because, you know, teachers like, oh, great, you got this, like, graphic novel and it uses some Shakespeare and it's got some Shakespeare quotations, but it's not going to totally weigh them down, and it's a neat way either for... We either get used by universities who want to use us to contextualize Shakespeare in a new way or talk about adaptation, or it's like, hey, let's hand it to somebody who hasn't hit Shakespeare yet and give them a little doorway in. And yeah, we always will show this one picture from a classic comics version of Hamlet from, I think, like 56 or something. And, you know, we like, this is an example about how to do two things really shittily. You know, it's not a great comic because you've given no room for the art, and who wants to read, like, who wants to, I mean, it's, like I said, it's 200 words. It's not as many words as you're going to see in a page, but somehow in a comic book, it's a nightmare. But I think in general, I guess it was just what I was saying before, I do think comics on the stage are very similar. I think they're really close kissing cousins. I think they're meant, they do a lot of the same things very well. And I think the nice thing also about comics is generally the comics audience are used to things being a little odd. Comics have been the, you know, the redheaded stepchild of, I can say that, it's okay. You know, the redheaded stepchild of the literary world for a while. I mean, people look at it like, oh, comics, the genre. Well, it's not, it's a medium. You know, and it tells all sorts of different stories, but people are used to a certain encounter with what a comic book should be. And because of that, it's good and bad, because I think sometimes there's a lower bar, and I think there are probably some comics that are... there are some comics that are probably not all that good that are given a pass because they're comics. And I think, sadly, there are some really, really great comics that are probably underappreciated and really maybe understudied in a way because they're comics. But for someone, you know, like us, who kind of, I guess, play in the middle ground, I mean, I think Kill Shakespeare is a good comic book. I think we're still very young in our careers, and it's not a great one. But there is a willingness for people when they pick it up to say, anything you do in the comics medium is okay. Because there are no rules in the comics medium. There is no such thing. I mean, there are kind of art comics, but there aren't really. Not the way you think of an art film. There is not, you know, it's not like Brechtian theater. You know, there is not something where you're going to say, oh my God, this is just broken down everything I thought a comic was. Because probably people don't think very much about comics. And that's great, because there is a freedom there. And so I think one of the nice things about working with Shakespeare is maybe you could make the argument that Shakespeare, while he was, as we said, was very much adapting the rules that came before him. I think a lot of people also believe that Shakespeare, you know, he certainly created language, but he created a lot of rules to the theater. And seemingly, it seems to us now that he was allowed to do so with very little repercussions. I'm probably sure that's not true, but I think the same thing with comics is there aren't a lot of rules that you can break, and so it's a nice match with Shakespeare, and I think it works nice, and I encourage people to, especially the writers in this room, I encourage them to play in the comics medium. It's a really forgiving medium, and it's a really kind medium to work in.
We only have a couple minutes, but I did want to offer the audience an opportunity to ask a question. So first hand up, I will call on you. There you go.
I like hearing Forbidden Planet mentioned. I want to give a shout out to Strange Brew as well. But from my own particular disciplinary area, video games, there has only ever been one video game in the history of the medium based on Shakespeare. It was actually a tie-in to Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet. And it's an odd video game. A really strange one. So why, in all the various adaptation areas, why haven't more people taking a run at putting Shakespeare into video games?
We're actually trying one. We're developing one with Canadian taxpayer money. So any of the Canadians in the room, thank you so much. I don't know. If comics are like the redheaded stepchild, then I guess like video games is that weird deformed, like, it's like Chunk from the Goonies that's like hidden in like the closet, right? I mean, you know, we're just now like having this discussion, like, could video games be art? It's like, holy shit, like a different medium has emerged, and like now we're just trying to respect it. I think, yeah, like, oh my God, shit, like Shakespeare in comics gets a bit of an eye roll, but I think Shakespeare, it's changing though. I mean, there's some great old textual games that use Shakespeare. They're like, I can't remember what it's called, but it's one of those classical text RPG type games, and you play Hamlet. And it's great. Talking to your father's ghost is so fun. Do you know what it's called?
No, I'm sorry, it's not that. It just made me think of another thing.
Oh, God, sorry.
Hamlet and a sort of game thing. So often, wait,
no, I'm good.
I was just wondering if you had heard of the Kickstarter project that's Choose Your Own Adventure in Hamlet. That's nice.
Yeah, Ryan North's project.
Which has won awards with Kickstarter.
Yeah, it's like this. For anybody who doesn't know, it's this project that basically does Hamlet as a choose your own adventure. Ryan's raised enough money that his book is now going to be 3 times as long as the original Hamlet. And he's also looking at doing a video game based on that. So there you go.
Do you remember if the artist involved is it? Because I'm mixing off my head if it's Noel Stevenson or Kate Beaton.
They're both involved, actually. Like, as Ryan got giant, like literally $500,000, giant truckloads of Kickstarter money dumped on his front lawn, he hired more and more artists. So yeah, both Noelle and Kate Beaton are going to be involved. And if you don't read their stuff, Google them because they're awesome.
All right, I'm going to give one more question. So right there, that's you.
I was just curious. You've talked about other mediums, but now we have Sons of Anarchy doing Hamlet on television. I just was wondering if anybody had thoughts on television as a home for Shakespeare.
Well, television's been a home for Shakespeare, at least on the BBC, as long as, you know, I grew up with regular Shakespeare every year or two. Somebody in the UK would try and do more or less complete runs of Shakespeare on BBC Two, and it was fun. But it tended... You know, the problems in the UK with that Shakespeare tended to be those of any kind of televised play, which are they were not written for television. And so the question becomes, do you start making the cuts that you need to make it good telly, or how do you do it? But it's definitely...
When Olivier did his Richard III, when it aired, they estimate that at that moment in history... It was watched by more people than all the other productions combined in history when it was shown on TV at that point. And since then, we've had many others that have been shown more. We have things like Moonlighting that have been adaptations of
Slings and Arrows.
Yeah,
The Lone Ranger. There are some scenes where the Lone Ranger becomes Othello. It's creepy.
There's a two-volume work by Richard Burt that catalogs encyclopedia-like all of that he could find. The Bugs Bunny cartoons, like A Witch's Tangled Hair. The Gilligan's Island episode, in which they do a musical version of Hamlet to the strains of La Traviata. But I would pick it up if you have a chance. But Mr. Gaiman is right. I mean, as soon as we had television, they started doing Shakespeare, including, notoriously, the uncut Time Life BBC.
Yeah.
So-called complete works of William Shakespeare.
I guess one thing that's interesting, though, about Sons of Anarchy is maybe that's talking about how TV is also coming of age as a medium, as an adaptation that is unabashedly doing, you know, it's mounting itself on Shakespeare. And, that has been done before, but I think people are getting more comfortable with the notion that, oh, hey, I can do that with TV like I could do that with film, because TV is now, has a different sort of juice than it used to.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we are sadly out of time. Could you please help me thank our panel members?